The House Committee on Land Use, this is the informational meeting that we're holding on Thursday, June 20th. So I will open the informational meeting. And first, we're going to have Chris Green and Paul Elsner come up. And we just want to hear a little bit about LID formation and law. And then we're going to hear about a particular LID, what we probably would call a horror story. So we want to know how it's supposed to work, who can opt in and opt out, how involuntary is it, and what's the theory here, how does it work?
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Crane. I'm an attorney with the firm of Beery Elsner. Here's Paul Elsner, Beery Elsner and Hammond in Portland. We're happy to speak briefly on the subject of LIDs and answer any questions you may have. With that, I'm going to basically step back. Paul has been doing this for decades and has worked on more LIDs than I can keep track of. So and he has more gray hair than I do. So
and less of it.
And so he has more credibility, and I'm just going to step back and let him go ahead and outline the LID process, what's required by statute, what statutes don't cover, so where local governments have discretion, how that plays out typically.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks for having us down, and I'm happy to answer any questions if I don't cover the topic in my general comments. As you know, an LID or local improvement district is a financing device.
Can you give us your name for the record?
Sure, Paul Elsner.
Yeah, thank you.
Do you need my address as well?
Okay.
And LID, or Local Improvement District, is a financing device. It's used not as regularly as it has been in the past by local government to finance public infrastructure improvements or public improvements. Public improvements is a limited class of topics. It's defined by statute, and it's basically the kind of what I would call the hard assets that most local governments have to deal with, which is roads, sewers, water lines, stormwater systems and the like. And what they are designed to do is basically create a way for either on the local government itself can try to create one, or property owners can try to create one. And you have to remember, this has been, in large measure, local improvement districts were designed basically to be used so that improvements in areas where people want to actually see them, so that their property, so that the benefited properties will then have access to basically commerce, is basically what it's there to do. State statute allows for their creation, and they also allow local governments to come up with their own set of rules. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to give you kind of an overview of how typically they're created. Typically what happens is either a local government can ask the city engineer, and that's usually the public official who starts it, to come up with a report to see whether or not a public improvement is needed in a particular area. It can also be done at the behest of property owners. If the property owners in a particular area want to see some public improvement, whether that's a sidewalk or a road or a water line or something like that, they then, if it's the property owners who do it, they file a petition with the local government. The local government then instructs the city engineer to then go out and do an assessment to determine whether or not that project is feasible. They then take that report that the city engineer develops, send out notices to the affected property owners that would fall within this artificially constructed district. Those property owners are then allowed to come in, take a look at the report that's been generated by the engineer, who then comes up with what they call a preliminary monetized value for the cost of the construction of the improvement. That then, they get notice of that, they come in and they can do what's called remonstrate. And remonstrate basically means they can stop the project, they can stop the local improvement district. Typically, that number before a local improvement district can be stopped at that juncture is 60% of the property of the, either it can be measured either by the number of property owners or the volume of property.
So individual property owners can't, but 41% could.
Individual property owners could not, unless they own, for example, maybe 60% of the property.
Yeah.
Okay? Then they could stop it. And typically under most of the ordinances that I have seen, it's typically for a period of 6 months. That then the local government cannot try to create another local improvement district dealing with that.
Just a clarifying question.
Representative Davis.
When you say 60%, that's 60% to stop it?
Stop it,
okay.
Correct.
So not 40% to stop it. It's actually
60%. It's what
supermajority needs
super
to
majority,
stop it.
Yes.
Okay.
Supermajority to stop.
Mr. Chair.
Wow. Representative Wisner.
Thank you. 60% of value, square footage, entities?
It could be any of those. That oftentimes is left to the local government to create whatever that majority is. And it doesn't always have to be 60%. It could be lower than that if the local government wanted it. So it could be the number of property owners. It could be the amount of property. It could be based on the valuation of the property. So it depends on how the local government wants to construct what that number, what that threshold would need to be in order to stop the creation of this local improvement district.
Thank you.
So, going off on that, so let's assume, for example, that what you have is a group of folks who don't want to have a local improvement district, and they get that number. That then means the local government can't even consider doing one or creating one in that area again for up to some period of time. Sometimes it's 6 months, sometimes it's a year. So, but let's assume that they don't get that. So then what it does is then the local government can then say, okay, we will create a local improvement district. And then describes the boundaries of that local improvement district. They then go out and hire a contractor to put in whatever the infrastructure is that they're creating by this local improvement district. It's constructed. They then have, at the close of the construction, when all of the costs are then known associated with the creation of the with a local improvement district, and those can include a number of things, including bonding costs, the actual construction costs, assuming that there were some legal issues involved, they can meld all of those things, and if they need in order to create the infrastructure they needed to do exercise eminent domain, they can bring in all of those costs. So what I'm trying to do is give you a sense of all of the costs that can be brought in. Then what they do is in that initial report that we talked about at the beginning, the engineer's report, they come up with a methodology that basically spreads that cost across the benefited properties, especially benefited properties, using a particular formula. And that can be any number of ways. And they've gotten more sophisticated from when LIDs were first created. I think they were probably created back in the 30s or in the 20s. Local improvement districts were allowed back then. For example, streets, you have to have, you don't have to have, but the courts have basically said there has to be some sort of rational nexus between the way you've created the methodology with a particular improvement. So in other words, if you have property that's along a street, the courts have held that basically if you do frontage on that street, that's a way to assess the cost for that street. So if you have 100 feet in front of a street and somebody next door to you only has 20 feet, the person who has 100 is going to pay five times more than the person who has only 20. For example, with stormwater, they might say, well, it's not going to be based on frontage. It may be based on area of the property, because stormwater will fall off that property into the stormwater system. Or they might then also do it for water lines. They might say, well, by the size of the access that you're going to be allowed to have from that water line. So if you have a big pipe coming off into your property, you're going to be charged more for that particular water line, for the cost of installing that water line. So if you put all of those things together, so there has to be some sort of reasonable relation between what the assessment is, or the assessment and the methodology. And then it's basically at the close of the close after construction, what you then have is the spreading of the assessment using that methodology that was set out in the engineer's report. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Davis.
So in regards to how those costs are allocated to properties, it just has to be essentially a rational basis and I imagine a reasonable nexus with the properties. So in a sense, it's fudgeable by the local jurisdiction. I mean, as long as they have a reasonable basis, it doesn't have to be. You gave the example of the street lengths,
right,
frontage. Even though it might be 100 feet and 20 feet, the local jurisdiction, as long as they had a rational basis, could say, well, even though that's 20 feet, it's better property or it has larger impact, so we're going to charge more. Is that?
They could. I mean, and that's what I, Representative Davis.
Yeah.
In fact, they have done, and I've seen an LID, for example, where they basically said, although you only have 20 feet of frontage,
mm-hmm,
that property is actually going to be more intensely used. For example,
right,
it may have different zoning. So what you may do is, for instead of a street, you may say, well, that street, that will, you will get a higher assessment than this one. This one may only be for single family residences, mm-hmm, and that one may be for a commercial use. So the commercial use may generate more traffic, so therefore that will be benefited more by the existence of that public improvement.
Okay.
So that's what I was telling you about. They've gotten a tad more sophisticated. So that's one thing that can happen. So then the assessment is spread. The person against the property against which the assessment is spread is basically has then a choice at the end, when the choice is you can pay the assessment in full, Or you can what they call Bancroft it. They don't typically use called Bancroft bonds anymore, but that's what everyone in the shorthand version of it is, which is
so
basically payable.
Pause for one second to
certainly
Representative Thatcher.
Well, I think he was kind of getting to it. I was wondering who is the judge as to whether a rational basis was properly applied.
Okay.
I think you're getting to
it. And that comes at the very end. Representative Thatcher, the short answer to your question is the court is the ultimate judge of that. That's going to be a question of law. So after this, at this point now that they've spread the assessment, these folks then have the ability to either pay it all in full or spread it out over time. Typically, since it is an LID, the public body usually issues bonds or somehow goes out for public financing rather than the person having to go out and do it on their own, which then means that they get, as you know, public bonding is cheaper money, and people then basically can pay over time because what the public agency has done is gone out, issued bonds, and then basically they say, okay, you're going to have to pay you're going to have to pay what we're paying in interest, and there's a limit on how much more they can charge. Typically, it's between 0.5% and 1% more. Above that, they run into arbitrage problems. Okay, they're not allowed to charge more interest, so you can't make money on the local improvement district, or on the sale of any municipal bonds. There's arbitrage rules. So that then, if the people don't believe that this point, and then they sign the agreement, and the agreement's terms are set out in statute. They're set out in ORS 223, and they become, if they pay it in full, obviously there's no lien. If they elect to pay it over time, and that there's a window, which is basically, it can go less than 10 years, but that's the rare case. It's usually between 10 and 30 years they have the opportunity to pay for the assessment over a 10 to 30 year period, and they're usually paid semi-annually. If they don't believe that they are, that the LID was created properly, or otherwise, or that their assessment is somehow improper, they then can file within 60 days what's called a writ of review. Writ of review is the way that local government decisions are analyzed by the courts. It's done on the record. And then what happens is the court then takes a look at the record that was in front of the governing body, and that includes the engineer's report, any testimony, the number of remonstrances, what people said during that testimony. And then they take a look at the relatively extensive case law in local improvement districts and analyze whether or not what the local government did was appropriate given the parameters of case law, they've overturned local improvement districts. Oftentimes, if they are changed substantially during the middle of the course, sometimes courts have overturned those. But typically, that's how the process is meant to work.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Elsner, you've early talked about the city's going to come in and determine the feasibility of the LID. That's pretty subjective, right? I mean, you're talking about we're trying to make it as objective and have as many different standards as possible, but the actual feasibility is pretty, and that's the beginning of the process.
Yes.
So if you have a property and you know how much that property is valued at, and your LID cost is going to come in at much more than your property is worth, that's not feasible. But
well, Representative Wisnant, what I'm trying to do, typically when I talk about feasibility, what the local governing body is basically saying to their city engineer, is basically say, go out and make an assessment using engineering standards as to whether or not this proposed public improvement makes sense, okay? And then what the engineer comes back is basically with an analysis, including a financial analysis, and they say, well, if you want that particular public improvement, it's going to cost this much money to do it, okay? And then they say, well, and since we're creating an LID, we're going to have to come up with a methodology. How are we going to cover these costs? Okay, how are we going to do that? And so then that engineer comes up and says, well, we'll use this approach. We'll spread it by the number of alternatives that I gave you. And the council then, it all has to be done with a public hearing. I mean, folks get to see and remonstrate against, and they say, well, listen, that approach that you just described in your doesn't make any sense. I mean, your analysis of how of the benefit to the particular properties doesn't seem to make sense to us. So they can say, I oppose that LID. And they can remonstrate. Now there are
Mr. Chair. So,
yeah, let's Representative Davis.
And that level of review is essentially, I mean, is it, what's the term of art? Is it a rational basis? That's a constitutional review.
Right.
Is it rational basis or reasonable or?
Yeah. I'll call it rational basis.
Okay. So it's relatively deferential to the city.
Yes, it's very deferential to the city. Okay, and you have to understand, I mean, for example, you couldn't create a local improvement district for something that has general benefit to everybody. Okay, so for example, a city couldn't create a local improvement district to build a city hall. Okay, you couldn't do that or build a police station. You can't create a local improvement. It's supposed to benefit a fairly discreet area, and it's supposed to give those properties benefits that do not accrue to folks generally. And that's what they're paying for.
I think we're probably going to move to our next part here in a second to hear about the process in a particular case.
But sure.
How are you supposed to determine benefits? Like, did you get sidewalks? What if you didn't get any of that? You got assessed, but
then
they didn't actually pave.
That's a basis for a challenge. You say, I wasn't benefited. I got no special benefit from the creation of this improvement because the improvements didn't go in front of my house, or I didn't get a sidewalk, and I can't be charged. Then the court would say, there's no special benefit to you resulting from that local improvement district, and as a result, you can't be assessed. And you also have to understand, too, I mean, I realize that my time is up, that this is all occurring in front of an elected body not unlike yourselves. They also understand that there's a political reality that they're also dealing with, and they're not going to necessarily do this kind of in a vacuum. And so they understand that, I think, as well. So that also should be taken into the calculus.
Good point. Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we lose these experts and the free legal advice.
Let's hope that it's worth more than that.
Yeah.
Okay, our situation, the case we're going to hear about, is they were in a minority position and were not able to opt out because the guy owned more, he owned enough that he had enough votes to say we're going to do it. Now, you know, and what we're going to discuss, I hope this committee is going to discuss, is some way that we can address legislatively that minority person who doesn't really want to get in this, or if his situation is such that he doesn't benefit from the LID, or he will not hinder the development of the LID with his property and by opting out. Is that a possibility?
It depends. Well, is that a possibility? Generally speaking, yes. It's a possibility.
Thank you. That's your challenge.
But I would say, for the most part, that's why you have that threshold that I was talking about early on, about the 60 or 40 or 51, 49. That's typically why that's when you go in and you remonstrate. If you've remonstrated against it, you can challenge it later on in court.
Thank you.
On what basis, though? If you were the minority and they set up the parameters with legal authority from the state to set up a 50-50 and or 51-49, and there were 49% of you, and there was 51, and they had set it at that, and you lose, and then you.
But as long as you're benefited, as long as what I assume by that is you weren't benefited and you didn't get the improvements in front of your property. If you got the improvements in front of your property, then you should pay. Then you should pay for it. Now you can negotiate with the city at some point and say. That no, I'd like to renegotiate that. And the city doesn't necessarily always have to basically spread all the costs. The city can keep some of those costs on itself. There's a fair amount of flexibility, but it's a financing device. You have to understand what a local improvement district is. It's meant to.
So let's say you're in the minority position of the whatever the interval is, mm-hmm. property owners, acres, dollar, whatever it is, you lost.
Right.
So now it's happening, and the plan is to benefit you as well.
Correct.
And you don't like either the assessment number, you know, you think it's too high, you think it's more than you can afford, you're not planning to develop it, so you're not going to sell it to make it back by having all this stuff. So what is your, I know the city, if you don't like it, and don't pay it, can take your property through foreclosure.
Correct.
What is your hammer, if you did benefit, to dispute a dollar figure that you've been tagged with?
You have the, well, there's,
that's good, excuse me, that's going to depend on the facts of that particular property, I think, and what the project
is. Who do you go
is.
To? Do you say to the court, wait, the city really put too big a number on here. I did not get that much benefit.
Well,
or do you go to city council?
I would think that you would go to city council if you think that there's that the number is legally defective based on the assessment formula. Then, of course, you can challenge that in court, and the court can take a look at that. But the court does not have what I will call, cannot exercise what I'll say the wisdom of Solomon and reallocate that. It can't act in an equitable fashion. There has to be some sort of a legal basis, some legal mm-hmm. argument that supports it.
In the corner.
And
as for example, I think we're going to hear in a minute
okay.
that
well,
some
I,
of the
I,
people
I
who got assessed have more acres and got a sixth of the assessment. They negotiated better. So we're not going to bring our target store here if you don't lower our assessment. So they did. People who don't really have a hammer didn't.
Right.
So 6 million here, 1 million here. This one's got more acres, but they got charged 1 million. These people have less acres and got charged 6 million. They didn't have the threat, though, of not bringing their target store there. So who do you go to when you think, wow, why can't I get that kind of deal and get my assessment lowered?
Well, the assessment, Chair Clem, the assessments are not supposed to be negotiable. They're supposed to be a calculation that allocates them on a formula, either square footage or road linear feet of road frontage. I was involved in a case recently. It was actually a reimbursement district, which is very like an LID,
right?
Yeah. Except for what happens,
no
person who constructs,
no
you can't foreclose
right.
it. But the determination of benefit and allocating the cost works exactly the same. And in that instance,
wheel and deal. If the city says I'm willing to absorb some of that, so. If one, but you're, or that's supposed to be all applied all across the
city? No, you can wheel and deal. No, I mean, the city, as I said, there's most cities allow for, and the statute certainly allows for you to basically, if the city wanted to say, we want to cover a portion of these costs out of our general fund, they can do that. The city can do that. So that's a political calculation that the city may want to do. It doesn't all have to be borne by the property owners. They can say, listen, there's a general benefit as well to other people throughout the city. We're now getting new infrastructure that may benefit. And so we as a city council, as the elected body, may choose to say, we're going to pay for a portion of this because that will lower the impact on these particular property owners.
Well, not necessarily. I'll pay yours, but you guys, I'm not paying any of yours. Like, it's supposed to be a formula. So if you're going to take money out of the total cost, it should
right.
come off the bottom line and not
correct.
Pay Target's thing out of our part, but everybody else, you're paying.
Oh, yes.
Rate.
That. Well, yeah, I would say that then you could then argue. Then I think that might form the basis for a legitimate argument that was not appropriate.
Yeah.
But Chair Clem, as I understand it, your question is, I guess I misunderstood the question. The allocations were made, but then a developer comes in and says, I'm only going to come in if you, city, pay that.
Lower mine. I don't know. We'll
right.
hear about it in a second.
Right. But the assessment was made on a based and allocated to the properties on a methodical basis.
Right.
Then my understanding has got changed due to complaints.
Okay. And I'm not familiar, since I'm not really familiar with that particular circumstance.
If you can stick around, that'd be great.
But the deference the court is going to give to the city in any of those cases, if there was wheeling or dealing or not, is going to be, like you said, the court's not going to exercise the wisdom of Solomon. It's going to say, did the city have a rational basis upon which to make this decision? And sufficient evidence.
And it's a substantial evidence standard.
Okay, that's a good point. Okay, substantial evidence standard.
Substantial evidence standard, which is...
Yeah, it's a little bit heightened.
Right, it is heightened. I mean, so there has to be substantial evidence in the record to support what the city did.
Okay.
And is a lot of this kind of freedom because the statutes don't prescribe a whole lot?
I would say that it is determined to be, oftentimes it's deemed to be a legislative decision, and so the courts basically say, we don't necessarily believe it's the court's function to interfere with the exercise of the legislative function, and so therefore that's why they defer. They say there has to be some evidence, though, there has to be substantial evidence to support the underlying determination that property may be benefited, that there's... that these improvements cost this much money, and that the allocation that the city council, when it was looking at the evidence that was presented to it to support the creation of the LID, there's some basis for that body to make that decision. They won't try to second-guess the decision, but they believe that there has to be some basis, in fact, in the record to support the creation of the LID and the assessment.
Chair Clem, there's one final thing I'd like. I don't know the circumstances of the Kaiser
situation.
We'll
bring it up back after they're done. Don't worry.
Yeah. Okay. I just want, academically, at least, once the LID is formed and the assessments are allocated and the liens are imposed on the property, if then a developer, a company or something wants to come in and develop one of those properties but makes the city or somebody else paying the lien a condition, the local legislative body can determine what incentives it wants to offer particular employers or classes of employers in order to land that business. I've seen the legislature do the very same thing through its tax code. There is a local, once the LID is formed and the assessments are filed and filed against the property, how those properties then subsequently develop are subject to local conditions and political considerations just like they would be here.
Yeah, and I think what we're going to hear about and what the legislature will have to look at is, are there enough parameters to protect the rights of the minority in the situation, especially if the ratio of what defines a minority is pretty wide open.
Right.
I mean, if there's no 50-50 or 60-40 or there's cities could make it 90-10 or 10-90, if there's nothing, I think that's the part for us to have is there. I assume these LID statutes are state statutes that they're working with.
Yes.
So if we're setting up a broad framework and then saying you've got it from there, and then people come back from the DALs and other places and say, hey, that broad framework, could you tighten that up a little bit with some sideboards? I think that's what we're starting to get to between this issue, that bill. I don't know what else is out there that we'll hear about, but
we're glad to stick around. I understand you guys have to be on the floor at 4,
yeah.
So get out of your way.
Okay, so let's get our...
And Mr. Chair, some of us have to go to Cox right now. I have had the opportunity, and I know some of us have, to meet with these individuals separately, and thank you and for taking the time to come. I apologize that a few of us have to go.
And I should just say for the record, Kaiser's material is posted on OLIS, and if you don't have it, I have a copy too. I will tell you, caucuses and all it's cracked up to be, you're welcome to stay, but you're a freshman, you're probably not supposed to do that. I spent my whole sophomore year not going
leaving,
either.
Nobody else is leaving, so apparently I'm
going. You're going to get in trouble. Sorry, Representative McLean.
Yeah.
So you are David Honeycutt and Linda Rawlings. Please tell us about what you know about LIDs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, and I appreciate the chair and the committee being here on this issue. This is an important issue. LIDs, local improvement districts, are certainly a legitimate method of funding special local improvements that specially benefit a particular area, and Mr. Elsner gave a very succinct and good sort of a background on how LIDs work. I've been dealing with this issue for quite some time, going back to a case that I got involved in the Tiger Triangle, where the LID was formed. It took the The total project costs were estimated at the time the LID was formed, and then they had a method of spreading the assessments, as Mr. Elsner indicated, a method of allocating the total project cost to each one of the property owners. In that case, that was all done, and you as the property owner make your decision on whether or not you want to be part of the LID as at that time. It took, in that case, 15 years for the project to actually be completed, and at the very end of that project, at the very end of that 15 years, my property owner in that district, who just happened to be a property owner who had owned land in that area for who had owned that particular land for decades through his family, the city at the end changed the spread of the assessments at the request of Winco and Costco, who were developing as part of the project. Their assessments went down, and my guys went up accordingly. So, after, 15 years after the time where he had his choice to make his decision on whether or not to come in and remonstrate against the formation of the district, all of a sudden, his expectations, which I'd say after the end of 15 years were settled by that time, were changed overnight because the city council decided to change how the assessments were going to be spread to benefit two of the major developers in the area, and we lost. We took that case to the Washington County Circuit Court, where Judge Nachtigall, as Mr. Elsner said, the judge isn't supposed to act with the wisdom of Solomon, but I think Judge Nachtigall felt sorry for us and acted with the wisdom of Solomon and said, this isn't fair. The city of Tigard then appealed that decision to the Oregon Court of Appeals, and the Oregon Court of Appeals looked at the law and said, look, this is okay, and reversed Judge Nachtigall. And we were down here clear back at that time trying to get LID law changed, and so this is another circumstance where that needs to happen. This particular situation involving the Rollins family in Kaiser, I think, is the most egregious example of why there needs to be some sideboards. You're right on the mark, Chair. We're not asking to eliminate LID law. It serves an important function and a valuable function. But the current legislation, the current statutory scheme for LIDs, is it leaves the discretion almost entirely with the local governments, and some sideboards, frankly, need to be imposed. In this particular Kaiser situation, I think, is an example of example A of why that needs to happen. And so at this point, I'll turn it over to Linda Rollins, and she can explain the situation, and I'll come in towards the end and fill in the details so that you all have an understanding of exactly what happened in this particular case.
Okay, so I'm Linda Rollins from Redmond, and back in 1996, myself and my husband, along with my in-laws, Jerry and Doreen Rollins, purchased 16 acres, which is what is now in the Kaiser Station development area. And back then, there wasn't a volcano ballpark. It was just farmland and farmhouses and stuff. And so we bought that property. We owned it free and clear. In 1999, the city came to us and wanted an easement put on there because they wanted sewer lines to go through our property to serve the volcano ballpark that was to be built. And at that point, we told them that would be fine to do that, but that we, as part of that easement agreement, we wanted the right to hook up to the sewer trunk line at no front foot charge to us, because we at some point someday wanted to develop that property, and we wanted the utilities firmly in place so that we didn't have to participate in any LID in the future. So city agreed to that, and you can find that in your information packet that I have for you. I think it's Exhibit A. And so then in about 2003, from what I understand, the Chuck Sides came to the city and proposed this Kaiser Station development, and I'm not sure about how all of it went down, because we really were out of it. We didn't live in the area, and so we weren't really privy to all of this. But from what I understand, the agreement for a deposition and development of the Kaiser Station project originally in is Exhibit B. Back in 2003, it lists all the property owners at that time that had properties that were to be in that Kaiser Station development. Our names and our property are not on this. So somewhere along the line in that time frame, the developer went to these property owners and purchased the properties from them. And then in 2005, they wanted to finalize the LID. And at that point, I believe that all of the properties, except for ours, were owned by the developer or some LLC that the developer owned. So in 2005, we received what is Exhibit D. We received what's called the Kaiser Station Local Improvement District. It's like a chart, I guess. And we saw our property on there and that there was two figures that totaled $6 million on there. And we just had a heart attack. I mean, we just didn't even know what it was or what it meant or anything. And they said that if you want to find out about this, you can go to the city council meeting on May 4th, 2005. So I called Shannon Johnson, who is the city attorney, and I said, I don't know what this is, but whatever it is, we can't afford it. We're making $30,000 a year, and, you know, we just were really scared. We didn't know what to do, sorry. So anyway, we hired a lawyer, and we went to the to that city council meeting on the 4th, and our lawyer told them that, you know, that basically we can't afford it and we don't want to be in the LID, and we have never had any negotiations up to that point with the city to be included in the LID, and we had not had any negotiations with any developer to lease our property or anything. And so at that meeting, the attorney for the developer and the attorney for Lowe's was present, and they basically told the city that there was a deal on the table for us to get that LID paid and for our property to be leased, which was news to us. We had no clue what they were even talking about. And so the city at that point, because of our lawyer's protest, did decide to postpone the decision to formally put the resolution you know, vote on the resolution till the next meeting, which was the 16th. So our lawyer went back on the 16th and again protested, but the city went ahead and voted on the resolution to form the LID. And I think that the Allen Roadhouse, who was the developer lawyer, said that at, on the May 4th meeting, when we had only had 10 days notice of having an LID put on our property, he said that the development schedule is at the end of the line. This is the last step before completing, before Lowe's can buy their property and start building. So they were just at the end of the line. They had already, you know, had all this. I mean, it was just already in the works before we even knew about it. So if you look back on Exhibit D, you'll see that our property was assessed for $6 million. Lowe's and Target were assessed for $1 million apiece. Their two properties total, I think, 23 acres, and they had a $2 million LID on it. Our property was 16 acres, and we had a $6 million LID on it. Our property is off to the side. It wasn't in the line of development, so to speak, for the Kaiser Station area. They could have easily gone ahead without us and developed that. It also has 4 acres of undevelopable land on it due to the Bonneville Power Administration having some power lines that go through there. So we raised all those points during the city council meetings, and the city council voted to go ahead and voted that resolution in. So then our only recourse was to file a lawsuit, which we did. We filed a lawsuit against the city and also with LUBA and proceeded to fight that LID. We borrowed $50,000 to pay the lawyer. And, sorry.
It was all the money they could borrow.
So anyway, several months went by, and the developer of that property finally approached us, and he said, you know, look, we'll lease the property from you. We'll make the LID payments for you, and, you know, we need to get this project going. So we just felt like we had no other recourse but to take take the developer's deal, even though we knew that it was a risky thing. So it was that or continue on with the lawsuit and hope that we would win in the courts, and we just had no idea whether we would or not. So as part of that, in order to get the lease, we had to agree to not protest the LID. So the city had us sign, I think it's It's at the very end here. I think it's the last exhibit. We had to agree to not protest the LID. So we felt like that was just our only option, so we went ahead and signed that agreement to not protest the LID. And the property at the time that the LID was placed on it was worth $300,000 according to the real market value on our property taxes, and the LID was for $6 million. Now the property is assessed at around $2 million, and the LID has grown to $6.7 million. The developer paid $1.5 million already of it, so there's an outstanding amount of 6.7 still after a 1.5, I believe, of the LID has already been paid. And our property is untouched. There is no change. In fact, when they excavated for the rest of it, they piled the dirt on our property, so these big, huge dirt mounds on our property now. And I have some pictures two in that packet, and so it's basically unchanged and untouched from the time that the LID was placed on there.
You don't feel like you got benefits?
I'm sorry?
You don't feel like you got benefits?
No.
Street, sidewalk, sewer?
There's nothing on our side, nothing. We already have...
Just the existing utilities that were run through for the stadium,
right,
that in a separate deal...
Right.
You gave them an easement in exchange for some cash plus the right to hook into it later.
Right. You know, across the street.
That was all pre-LID for me.
Right. That was all pre-LID. Across the street now we have the Kaiser Station is there, but our property on our side of the street is untouched. There's nothing. They haven't done a thing to it. And it's frankly undevelopable because the LID is so large that nobody wants to pay $6.7 million for a piece of property that's worth $2 million. And there's been several deals that have been fallen out of bed, so to speak, because the LID is just so outrageous that nobody can make that work.
When was the last time that Mr. Sides made the payment?
About 2.5 years ago.
And then I thought I'd seen in Kaiser's stuff, I don't know how they would know this, but did I see something that he is paying lease payments to you, just not paying to them, or is he behind on everything?
He, back when they started having financial issues, when the market took its downturn, they came to us and they said, look, we can't make the payments that we've agreed to make to you. So we negotiated with them that we would take 50% less on our lease payments from what we were supposed to take in hopes that would help their cash flow and enable them to somehow be able to pay the LID or get the property developed. So we took a 50% cut just overnight, which in itself is a whole nother story, from our income in hopes to to help solve this. And they have continued to make that payment. But even if they had continued to make the 100% of the lease payments to us, and we had turned every single penny over to the city, we still would be in default. And the city told us that they won't take partial payments, they only will take complete payments, and there was no way to pay that. Even if we had taken every dime that we had gotten from them, it still wouldn't have.
How much are the payments to the city, Linda?
$250,000 every 6 months.
I, just by coincidence yesterday, I can't find it now, but I noticed that he bought something yesterday for $1.25 million, some new property somewhere.
Mr. Chair.
I'd like to go take it. I'll take my gavel and get it, and I'll give it to
It's probably you. That. Was it the Millersburg? Was
yeah,
that?
I think so.
That's it's not him, but.
Yeah,
Mr. Chair, the lease agreement is with a limited liability company, and as I understand it, there are 32 lawsuits
on that one.
Well,
LLC.
On Chuck Sides and.
So,
yeah,
so
a long line of
even if the Rollins were able to afford to hire counsel to litigate, it would be like squeezing blood out of stone.
And let me just say one last thing. When we bought this property in 2006, it was to be our retirement. You know, that's why we wanted to stay out of the LID. We just didn't want to develop it. We had a little farmhouse on there that we were renting for $700 a month, and we just wanted to stay that way. My in-laws, who are in their late 70s now, Jerry Rollins has dementia. And I just, you know, if they lose their income, I really don't know what they're going to do.
Let me fill in a little bit here. And I hope the import of what Linda said isn't lost on the committee. This was a property that was worth, that was valued by the county at $300,000. The amount of the LID was $6 million. So it was 20 times the value of that property, the assessment. The Rollins family went to Kaiser and said it might as well be $6 billion. We can't pay $6 million. We can't pay it. We don't have that money. The remedy for...
And was that during that remonstrate opportunity?
Well, they came along, as Linda indicated. Their property wasn't part of the LID till the very end of the project when the Kaiser City Council, as they indicated in the minutes that's in your packet, were already negotiating with Lowe's to start construction. Do you think that there would really be any opportunity at that point for the Rollins to successfully get the Kaiser City Council to say, well, we're going to take another look at this? Of course not. The Kaiser City Council had stars in their eyes because they wanted the Kaiser Station project to develop. The property, the developer that wanted the Kaiser Station project owned the vast majority of the property at that point. So even if the Rollins family would have remonstrated, they might as well have spit into a fan. They didn't have enough horsepower, either financially or in terms of ownership of the property, to ever remonstrate against the formation and get Kaiser to back off from the formation of the district. So this was happening whether they liked it or not.
Did we talk about here, or I can't remember if it was in my office, the concept of the revision in total projected needs for the LID? All of a sudden it was like, well, actually it's going to be $6 million more than we thought, and then all of a sudden they get a $6 million assessment.
Yes.
The same amount that the overshoot on the original LID projection was.
Right. Yes.
Coincidentally.
Yes. Coincidentally. And the problem that this case illustrates, I think, better than any other, is that these folks were at the mercy of someone, of a developer who was substantially more sophisticated and essentially had control of the process, and a city council who had stars in their eyes because they thought of all the, they thought that the development was going to be essentially be the linchpin for the city. I get all of that. But a bad bet was made. The economy turned south and there was a bad bet made. The bad bet was made by the Kaiser City Council and by the developer. And yet the only people being asked to pay that bad bet are the one family that came in and said, don't do this. We don't want you to do this. We can't pay it. We're never going to be able to pay it. And now the only remedy for Kaiser to recoup their $6.7 million owed on that on their assessment. Kaiser has collected about $1.5 million from the developer pursuant to the lease agreement, and the Rollins family has collected about the same amount in lease payments under that lease agreement, but the developer is now Gunnysack, or the LLC, and so the only remedy for Kaiser at this point is to foreclose on the property. So they're taking the one asset that this family has, the only asset that they have, their retirement, in order to pay on a bad bet that they got into with the developer.
And I assume the developer probably told them, oh, don't worry that it looks like these people are getting, is any elected official would feel pretty awkward when you say that until someone goes, oh, we're going to pay her bill, don't worry about that. Oh, okay.
They just took it.
And then they didn't.
Well, the idea was, at the time, was that this property was going to develop as part of Kaiser Station. But the economy turned. Yeah. And I understand that. But now that the economy turned and the bet's gone bad.
How, when you don't have anything new, you benefited? I don't see how they could actually legitimately assess you when you didn't get it. If you got all this new sidewalk sitting out there, and the market's bad, at least it's got value to sell to somebody now. But a $6 million bill and nothing
Right.
It sounds illegal. I mean, what they described, the definition of benefit, it doesn't seem to be at work here.
And so well, and the other thing is that, you know, we got a 10-day notice that we were being included in that LID. You can't do anything in 10 days. And it's like our lawyer said at the time, you get more time to respond to a dog bite lawsuit than the Rollinses have been given to respond to this LID. And at that original May 4th meeting, Chris Epley said that the interim line of credit set for May 16th will be thrown off if the LID is not approved. They had already, it was a done deal. We were just formality to them, and we were given a 10-day notice.
And they were probably being told by people they trusted that they would make the payment on your behalf, so you don't really need to worry about it.
Right, which wasn't true. We had no deal with anybody to pay that.
Okay, other people interested in asking more about this? I've heard more in my office, obviously, and I'm probably skipping over some for the public record of what I know, but Representative Thatcher.
Dave, you mentioned that there was a situation you were involved with in Tigard a few years back, and now this one, and not that maybe you were involved in them particularly, but are there other issues like this? I mean, is this happening with other people around the state?
Well, we just had this session, House Bill 3479, which dealt with fees in lieu of local improvement districts.
Yeah.
But yeah, as this is a real problem, and it's got there's problems on all sides because the cities have a legitimate need to have the money available to do the financing to create the infrastructure in order to allow development to occur, and nobody quibbles with that. But at the same time, imposing an LID assessment of 20 times the fair market value of someone's property is indefensible. And then knowing full well that no one will buy the assessment, as I think Mr. Elsner indicated, the assessment acts as a lien on the property. The Rollins family personally don't owe City of Kaiser $6.7 million, but their property does. And no one will develop, will buy their property because the lien runs with the land. No one will buy their property that's worth $2.2 million now with a $6.7 million lien on it, unless there's some kind of surety that they'll be able to develop something that will generate that kind of income. That was what Kaiser was betting on, and the developer were betting on at the time that they put the Rollins property into the LID. But that turned out to be a crummy bet. And now they're asking this family to suffer the ultimate price for making that bad bet.
Representative Thatcher.
And follow up. And in your experience, do you believe there might be a way to make this, I mean, because this, I know the city's in a box. I know the Rollins should not be left holding this big assessment. Do you think there might be a way to figure this out and make this less of a lose-lose situation than it is right now?
Chair Clem, Representative Thatcher, I think the answer to that is yes, but it takes two to tango. The Rollins family at this point is, we have a letter. The family got a letter, their lawyer did, indicating that Kaiser is planning to foreclose. They can foreclose at any time. And Kaiser's offer was, we will foreclose on your property, but if you sign a deed to deed the property over to us and give up your rights to repurchase the property, because once your property is foreclosed, you have the right to repurchase it. If you'll do that, we'll pay you $25,000 and you can go away.
Oh, my God.
City government.
Vice Chair.
What country do we live in?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, what we're asking for, at this point, there's no bill available at this point in this session to try and fix this.
You serve in the military?
For what? But what we're asking for
protect this lady.
Is that the committee will work on this in the interim and come up with legislation that makes sure that this doesn't happen anymore. Sideboards are what is needed, and if we can... If if we can get the city to cooperate with the Rollins family and their lawyer, I'm not representing the Rollins in their litigation. If you can get the city to work with the Rollins and their lawyer on some creative ways to solve this problem, that would be, that's what ought to happen here.
We've tried that. We did. We hired Ron Bryant, and I think, wonderful man, to work with Shannon Johnson for several months now. They've gone back and forth, and Shannon and the city have given us nothing. So.
Yeah, well, I definitely am happy to commit us to working on it in the interim sideboards. You know, I wish I could say I've had good luck telling the city of Keyser, look, you're going to lose in court on this, so don't do it. But I have tried that, and that didn't work either. I'm not a lawyer, so I had LC say that in a letter. That didn't work either, so I don't even really know. Because I clearly don't think that they're the benefit. I don't see how they could win that they gave you benefits for the $6 million, but that means you got to pay somebody to take that all the way through. And
right.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I think the problem with that is at this point, the time to challenge that is long come and gone.
That's nice. That's just great. Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Honeycutt indicated to me and Mrs. Rollins earlier that because it's in court, if we do pass legislation in the next session, that they would still affect the Rollins family. Is that correct, Mr. Honeycutt?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, as long as the case hasn't completely resolved so that you have a final decision, the legislature, I believe, retains the authority to make the statute retroactive and affect potentially the outcome of the pending litigation.
Well, let's do it.
Okay.
And we have redemption. I think there's a redemption right period.
Either of you want to now comment on that? You don't have to. I'm not. You did me a favor by coming up at all anyway. So, okay. We're late for the floor. Yeah. Thank you for telling us your story. Let us see what we can do to help now and later. And with that, we'll close our informational hearing.